before we jump into the T4 bacteriophage, T4 lysozyme, which I don't even know if I still know what kind of enzyme it is. I wanted to just kind of follow up on a few quick things. At first, you weren't sure if you spent 6 years or 7 years in Oregon, but it's 6 years, right? We just, okay.
6 years.
And now you met your wife in Oregon.
That's right.
Okay. And it's this 19. Person who you call Julie, whose name is Julie Clem on some of these papers, correct?
No.
No. Darn it, I was a dumb good detective. Now, you didn't meet her till the end? I mean...
1985.
And you got there in 82, 83.
Yeah.
Okay, so... We'll put that off until the right time, and we'll talk about it if you want to. The other thing was, you also said that you had a hard time getting a job, and that was maybe perhaps another reason you stayed another year. You know, you were just... Now, I was... The job market just was, real stinky, right? Is that what you were saying? Or you went out to look for jobs, and people said, we don't want... I mean, I wasn't quite clear on that.
I think it was a combination of factors. Structural biology was not the fad that it is now. And many of the jobs that I interviewed for, people couldn't decide whether they wanted a Drosophila geneticist or an X-ray crystallographer or a, you name it.
They were just that open and wide. So,
right.
At places like, do you remember any encounters?
Name a place I didn't go.
Okay. So you tried, really, there were that many, there were at least that many jobs to, apply for and be interviewed.
Oh, yeah.
So you got interviewed for a lot of jobs.
Yeah, got interviewed for a lot of jobs. So then I think the other factor is I probably didn't give a very good talk.
Okay.
Didn't give a good lecture.
You just weren't, you didn't have enough stuff, you thought, or you just didn't give a damn? Process and
I was always very nervous about speaking and wasn't that well organized sometimes in the way that I laid out the work, and also the work itself had some ambivalence to it. Well, we were making some progress in terms of technical accomplishments, right? We were making mutants at will.
Yeah.
And determining structures at a rate where the structure became a useful experiment, an assay, if you will.
Right.
So technically it was something new, but the answers were still pretty complicated. So I imagine, although I don't know, that people might come away from some of the early work, especially when we were just right in the middle of studies without having tight conclusions, that people would come away saying, gee, this is interesting, but what have they learned?
Mm-hmm. So you were kind of applying for jobs over a period of years? I mean, we're not talking just like 1 year. We're talking like maybe you started in 85 and then it went on to 86 or, whatever.
I think 86, 87.
Okay.
So. Starting in 85, yeah. And the other thing that happened at a couple of places is basically the university decided they were interested in the area and went out and tried to hire Brian Matthews, whose lab I was working in. So Brian got a lot of job offers.
From your talk?
He would have to go down and give the talk, but people would sort of say, if they could get Matthews, why not get Matthews instead of Albert?
Because he was at, Oregon, and that wasn't quite...
Well, this is the odd sort of hubris of these places, of Berkeley and Caltech and you name it.
Okay.
Go down the line. Stanford. They think, why would anybody want to live in Oregon?
There forever, right? I mean,
yeah. So
since he was a postdoc, right?
His postdoc, he went to Eugene. He was a
postdoc at Cambridge. And he's not leaving, right?
Right, exactly. And so they sort of wondered what he was doing there. He's very good, brilliant crystallographer. Let's get Matthews. So
And he's not the only person up there at this institute or in the chem or biochem department, right, who's good. I mean, there are other people. I mean...
Oh, no, it's a very well-known group up there. Okay. A lot of people in the National Academy.
True. Mm. So, I mean, they must have... Maybe hubris is the right word, huh? I mean, they were just being ignorant or kind of... Well, I guess they figure most people would want to move from Eugene to the Bay Area or Eugene to... Well, Pasadena, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting. But all of a sudden, that kind of made them click and think. And he went and did a lot of the... I mean, he went at least to check it out.
Oh, yeah, and he got interviews at Stanford and Berkeley and Caltech and ETH in Switzerland.
And he didn't take any of them because they didn't offer him the moon and the stars and the sky as well?
I think... He and Helen, his wife, very much like Eugene, and there's a lot of loyalty there, and their kids are raised there. And I think, to get the details, you should talk with him. I think the closest place they considered going was Stanford, and my understanding of that was that the financing wasn't tight enough or wasn't organized enough. So they didn't offer to set up the lab.
That is hubris, then, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We'll recruit you, but it's kind of iffy.
So then they realized what kind of mistake they made and got the money together, but by that time he had lost interest.
Yeah, and it's clear that this is your understanding and not, you're right, it's not Brian, you're not speaking for him and I'm not asking you to. If I ask you about a lot of these people, I guess I'm kind of asking... in a sense, for your opinions. But at the same time, we're getting a picture of the milieu you're working in, right? What it was Oregon like. And that's really what I guess, not just what a catch Brian Mathers would be or, how he deals with job offers. I do want to get something about him in this. As I think
sure.
I explained off tape, we're kind of cheating and using you guys to get at your mentors as well.
Okay.
Not about... all the nitty-gritty or maybe some of the personal details, you're right. We know you applied for a lot of jobs. You just had said you had, that this was a situation that made you stay longer in the lab up there. Had you thought of, did you interview at biotech firms, or was that, you just weren't going to do that? You were going to either get an academic job or you were going to, wait tables somewhere or,
I don't know.
Or something.
It wasn't that, or write novels, I think, would have been would have been more interesting. Let's see. One thing that's happened to me in the last few years is the process of becoming mortal, and it happens to different people at different ages, and it happened to me pretty late. What that translated into is that until I was mortal, there was infinite time to do everything, right? So there wasn't any rush to leave Eugene. Sure, I was there 6 years in it, but I didn't have, a grand plan for my life in the sense that I had to do certain things by a certain time. I was being productive there, and I felt that, I could continue to do good work. And I didn't really need to leave. Brian was happy to have me there.
So you could have maybe just stayed there sort of too. I mean, for ever and a day, as a kind of a lab, maybe until an academic position opened up there or a research position or grants would have kept you going there for a decade or,
Well,
you just didn't have to worry. You didn't worry about that. There was good work going on there and you were doing it. Is that kind of the sense you want to...
Certainly by the time that things were going well, I was happy with the work that was going on and the work I was doing. So intellectually, I wasn't in a rush to leave. I didn't contemplate staying forever. First of all, it's very hard to stay in a place where you do your postdoc. I think personally I was sort of going crazy living my life on residential streets and discovered that Oregon is charming, but didn't, you know, left some things to be desired.
You mean kind of cultural?
Well, cultural or just the energy level or something. Eugene's a pretty small town.
Mm.
Yeah. And I was, by the time I left, I was happy to be moving to a larger city.
Do you think that maybe having more going on around you makes you more active too? Or?
Oh, yeah. I love New York, for example. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not that, you know, I don't like to climb or go hiking or go to the mountains or ski or be outside in the wilderness, but I also enjoy cities.
Mm-hmm. This is maybe a good compromise here, and maybe Salt Lake was...
Salt Lake was really good that way, too, yeah.
So
I was pretty frustrated, I think, by the process of not getting an academic position easily, although I had lots of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the effect of it was that I really lost a lot of self-confidence during that period.
In the work you were doing, I mean, in the sense of facing the lab work you were doing and the work and the way you were thinking about doing things, or just in this kind of, I've got this, you know, this drive, this thing that makes me, I mean, I think there's, you know, kind of another part one has to worry about in a very competitive world, which I think basic research, you know, basic biological research is very competitive. And was that kind of the self?
Just in terms of how the work we were doing really stacked up.
And so it was kind of intellectual.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, to do a set of experiments, you have to believe that they're the right thing, mm-hmm. right thing to do, and you know, you have to believe in yourself.
Right, regardless of the kind of maybe response for a while, or especially if it goes against certain kinds of dogma or whatever.
It's got to be, in the long run, it's got to be independent of recognition, although, I mean, it's becoming completely obvious that people tend to work much harder if they're recognized.
Mm-hmm. You know, no, I mean, I think that's why, you know, in the competitive world, that's why the self-confidence or this kind of sense of yourself as being recognized, as having the kind of, you know, abilities to give that lecture that's catches people's ear, and to have people say, oh, that's, you know, person X, she does this kind of work and she comes from this pedigree, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's such an important reminder. That's what people tell me, actually, what you guys have told me. That it, and it actually, I think it's more like ambition is 9/10 of, you know, of doing good science, and the other 10th is luck. It's basically what it boils down to. That's a common, I'm not saying, you know, monolithic view of the world, but a common one, that you've got to, you know, go for the gold. And, you know, it's because it's the people who are kind of, you know, I like biology and I'm good at it, but, you know, I don't want to work 80 hours a week. I want to play golf some of the time. Well, you know, those people are going to go fall by the wayside.
Well, I would somewhere add talent in there.
A
little bit of talent, yeah.
Or
something.
Let's just say
that ambition can be substituted by talent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helpful to have
more
talent.
I think that's another view of things, too, right?
I think people say that about Madonna. Yeah.
Well, she says, I think Madonna's the one who puts forth, but, you know, didn't she name an album Blonde Ambition, I believe?
People say this is the one person who succeeded on ambition.
Mm. Depends on if you like Madonna or not, right?
Exactly.
I guess maybe perhaps you don't, or maybe you can't defy the ambition to see if she has any talent. I don't know myself, but... I mean, yeah, that's the other side, I guess, of the coin. People would cut down a lot on the ambition, you know, and give it only, you know, 3 parts, and give another 4 or 5 parts to, like, what you used to call talent, I mean, what other people might call it, you know, variety.
Maybe this is a more important point than our laughter indicates, you know, that, you know, we talked about this, I think, last time, that there are other models. People who have done science and focused on either curiosity or vision about the natural world, you know, and certainly when I look at my mentors, they've all had that to great measure, and you know, I haven't really worked with people who can wheel and deal, and that's the whole extent of their their genius.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I've come across, and I don't mean people, definitely I've interviewed, I'm not going to, you know, certainly name any of the Pew Scholars I've interviewed, but just in my exposure, maybe to other people through Pew Scholars, to people who, yeah, they'd make great lawyers, I think, if that's what they had nose for when they were in college or something, or that's what they found out that they did really spectacularly in, but no, it was mathematics, and that kind of pushed them into science or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's a lot of that. I think I'm not very good at that, and I'm a pretty low key person who's more focused on the technical issues,
and maybe some of the more esoteric and intellectual issues behind the technical things, like questions about, you know, organic molecules.
Well, I think one of the things I said about Greg Petzko is that he's really bored by doing something twice.
Mm-hmm.
And he always said it's worth trying to do something that wouldn't have been done if you hadn't done it. And it's very hard to do that all the time, but it's certainly something I try to keep my eye out for. And I wouldn't necessarily call it esoteric. But different, you know.
It's actually, this relates to something that I was going to bring up maybe at another time, but we can bring it up now, and that was your, I thought an ambivalent kind of discussion on your part. You talked about, well, of course, what you have to do is turn out the product, and that's what you're here to do, and that may sometimes, you know, the rest of the stuff that you think about in this attitude and approach you're talking about now, you know, is kind of your approach, may get in the way of that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And you said, you know, and I hope nobody listens to this tape or reads this transcript because I've just, you know, and you meant your people in your lab, who of course are expecting you to be turning out product, of which I'm sure they're part of.
I meant the people that fund my work, the Pew Foundation.
Although the Pew is not
interested in the product, as I understand the foundation.
Yeah, they certainly don't think they're looking at these things to evaluate what kind of product they got.
Yeah.
We've been told that, so.
Yeah. Lucky you.
I certainly am approaching it from that vein and telling interviewees that they can go ahead and say anything they want about the Pew. The Pew's not going to read it like that. If they read it at all, if they be anybody,
yeah.
I guess maybe Ed O'Neill or something. Anyway, I was just getting this kind of, you know, and I wanted to, the way I wanted to ask the question was, although you see yourself sometimes as this turning out the product thing and getting grants and keeping a lab running and getting some people maybe some decent jobs and training them to be good scientists and think about stuff in a scientific way, and then this kind of other world or other way of working which you have mentors as guides for, in a sense, as well as your own way of thinking about things. Do the two really conflict so much? And what's the better, you know, without being idealistic and, you know, kind of like not thinking about the real world, is there what is the better way? I mean, is there a way to turn this product stuff into some, you know, or back to maybe there's an, maybe there's a way science was done that you, you know, you're more familiar with, or you think was in the past that was less on the product emphasis and more on the, you know, asking the right questions and pursuing them and getting some answers sort of thing. Am I being at all
clear? I think the impression I'm getting from the question is sort of what's the balance between sort of numerology and numbers of papers and numbers of people and amounts
and the way
of
they
money
want you to do things, yeah,
versus the sort of more detached approach that may focus on quality.
That you couldn't do what Barbara McClintock did, because, well, you need a lot more equipment, and it's more expensive, and more people. Just even that level alone, you know, that physical, if you will, necessity of doing the kinds of things you're interested in doing, never mind that, you know.
Well, I think with different people, there are different optimal strategies, right? That's true of people in your lab or heads of labs. You know, some people really are good managers. They can have big groups. They can keep things organized and, you know, essentially turn out the product. Some people are not good at that, but maybe they have some deeper insights or, you know, are more careful, more subtle, and make contributions that are fewer in number, but just as important. For both of these types of extreme types of people, there's no substitute for getting the result. You know, for a student who you're trying to teach to do careful experiments, if they're not in there, you know, trying to do experiments
carefully.
If they're not in there, you know, at least making mistakes, you're dead, and or they're dead, you know. And in terms of learning how to do good work, there's no substitute for doing good work. You know, it's fine to say something to someone in abstract. You should do controls to rule out alternative models when you do an experiment. But the person who sort of does that organically is someone who's done it, not someone who's thought about doing it. And so I guess I don't really think of this as a, you know, as a theoretical exercise. It's something that people have to go and do, and that's how they learn how to do it. And then I mean, there are certain ways to stimulate people to think and think for themselves and come up with
and
conclusions and read the literature. And there are certain elements of how people get to become good independent scientists. But and you can do those things. You can tell people to do those things or encourage people to do those things. But you can't learn how to do it without doing it.
And maybe perhaps the other way, I mean, that's the one extreme of the thinker and the, you know, the kind of engaged mind having to also maybe be taught and have to learn and experience the fact that, okay, you need to turn this into something that other people will be interested in knowing about, you know, so publishing, and you have to learn about the fact that other people work with you on these things. You can't possibly do this kind of science anymore on your own in your garden with your peas. You have to, you know, you have to get along with people, and then you have to find some money because it's expensive, and that perhaps the two are kind of working each other out to the, not maybe the best possible world for doing science, but one of a one of the possible worlds of doing science. In other words, the compromising or whatever that one does, and
well, balancing.
Different
activities, sure. Yeah.
All right. And that's not too bad, right? That if you could just kind of check out to some place like Oregon and just kind of, you not have to ever worry about money and just think about things that you might not get as much done that way. I mean, you just, it might not be as,
Well, I mean,
there
are a lot
productive or as fruitful.
But different people fit into these situations in different ways. I mean, Oregon is more isolated, and there's less connection to the world, and there's less pressure, and there's less having to worry about what people down the street are doing, you know, up at the other end of Mass Ave.
And you certainly see right? the world. Yeah.
And you just go out there, and you think for yourself, and you figure it out, and you think, this is the way to do it. And maybe you do it slower. Maybe you don't worry about the competition as much. And people who are who function well in that sort of environment, you know, will thrive at a place like Oregon. Whereas, even say comparing Harvard and MIT. As a graduate student at MIT, you know, the reputation of Harvard was, they sit around and think all the time. And the style at MIT is you just get in there and work. And you get so many little bits of data that you don't have to think about it anymore. I mean, it's on your feet and you smell it, you know. And so you know what it is, you know. And any fool could figure it out with all the data that you've already got, whereas, you know, other universities have a model where you get what might be called the minimum amount of data to draw the maximum amount of conclusion, you know, and the styles are different and people are different and some people do well in one and some people do well in the other. I don't think there's a unique solution.
And you've kind of, you know, you've certainly been around the block in the sense of having done maybe some, you know, real, you know, pressure type turn, you know, as well as being able to take the time to sit back and, for instance, we were talking off tape about how to approach this review thing. That seems to me kind of, you know, that's the thinking part or that we were talking about of the taking the time. I mean, that must have been as beneficial to you as to anybody else who gets to read the article. I mean, you must have had to kind of, you said the hardest thing was figuring out how to put it all together. And that must have made you think about a lot of these questions over again in a kind of contemplative way as opposed to this is my little area that I'm doing. And I'm sorry, I did not mean little to sound like it's, you know, but this is my part of this work, and this way you get to kind of fit it into the puzzle more. And you certainly seem to do those sorts of things as well as do the product.
The product, yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of product here that I'm holding in my lap as well.
Well, I think just for me personally, I like solitude. And, you know, being in Utah or being in Oregon, or when I was thinking about that review, I was traveling around the wilds of Australia with Julie out in the middle of nowhere. And there was, you know, desert or barrier reef or whatever out there.
And it helped you do this sort of thing.
Yeah, just it, I find it stimulates synthetic work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where a lot of the little details sort of slip away and you're trying to figure out how it all fits together. Or, you know, walking down a dirt road with a moon and the dogs running up ahead and, you know, you're thinking about the moon and the night air and random things that you know, cause things to fit together.
No direct
cause
way
other
of
thoughts
saying, but just kind
fit
of
together.
Give your mind a chance maybe to start, you know, doing that kind of thing, which is maybe pondering or something and maybe letting go of a lot of, you know, loose facts.
Loose details.
Yeah, I don't know if now's the time to do this, but was like coming to Berkeley jumping back into a kind of a faster paced thing, or is this kind of isolated or in between a Utah and an Oregon and that?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, this is a big change, and the position of the lab is very different. My what role in the field may be changing, the sorts of scale of things that I'm expected to do has really changed. And I'm not... It's a challenge. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a challenge. And in terms of my own career, I think it was... Or my own life, it was a godsend to be able to go to some place like Utah, which is interactive and supportive and low key and genuine. And get the tenure thing out of the way, and get some work done, yeah. And things like that. Excuse me.
Back on somewhere, talking about what Utah had to offer to you in a sense, but also then what taking, kind of taking up the challenge here. I think you were leaving off on the point of talking about the, getting the tenure thing out of the way and being able to start some work and maybe start, a different kind or a different scale of that work.
Yeah, different scale, different style. Berkeley's different. So,
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. You know?
You've been here 7 months, right?
Yeah.
I think you got here just before. Well, actually, maybe almost 9, 10, almost a year in October you moved. Or
end of October, yeah.
But when I was here in January, things were just kind of, I guess, just had geared up and things were kind of in place, but there was still no electricity or something like that.
Yeah, the equipment wasn't running. Okay. But, things are already going quite well, and students have lots of nice results just in the last few weeks, and so it's very encouraging.
Been throwing these typescripts, these manuscripts at me left and right, so some of them were, I think, longer planning than just a couple of weeks ago, but obviously I think one certainly was just kind of put together, right?
Most of the work is work we did before I moved.
Okay, I'm just getting around to writing it up. I thought one of it was even kind of like submitted in June.
The papers were two submitted in June and one in July.
I guess I kind of take that as that everybody's finally looked at the paper and had their say and what their, that sort of thing. And that, to me, is kind of like, oh, it's rare. I mean, maybe, you kind of think of it, geez, we did that work a year and a half ago, and it's about time everybody got their, got their approval in and we could send it off. I don't know, maybe I'm looking at it. But perhaps,
It's hard.
Things that have happened a couple of weeks ago, as you say, that's going to another year before they're written up and out.
No, I'm behind. It's hard to write. It's been hard for me to write in the midst of the move and be caught up on that aspect of things,
And we can talk about this, the most recent stuff at the end. I don't really have anything further. I just want to kind of follow through again. Since you had also brought up this... again, this discussion about the way that maybe some people got to do science in another time or another place, and looking at the different things and now what it was, and we could kind of follow that through. That's about your style of science, and I consider that something to be kind of important to cover, and I find that people are, that I've interviewed, people whom I've interviewed, use the word and talk about their style, and it's a conscious sort of thing that they interact with, when they think about what they're doing. So unless there's something you wanted to continue with, or to follow that through, or...
Well, actually, I thought we might get that information just by, say, talking about the move to Eugene and the work there.
Right, and you had basically talked about the move, I think, and why you went there and why you didn't go to Cambridge, and
sure.
I'm glad, I think where we need to pick up, in a sense, from that is just what happened when you got there, and what did you start working mm-hmm. on, and why, and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And without me setting that.
Yeah, so after I built furniture and went to the coast and things like that, I got to the lab, and I think most of the things I proposed to do for my postdoctoral fellowship were being done by other people in the lab by the time I got there. And the one thing that wasn't being done was quite difficult. It was to look at the structure of T4 lysozyme and of mutants at a temperature just below where the protein would unfold to try to see if we could use crystallography to get an image of the protein falling apart. And of course, the problem with that is that it's hard to collect data at high temperature, X-ray data at high temperature, and also if the protein falls apart, the crystal of it is also going to fall apart, so you can't collect any data. So it was something that I had proposed to do and something I thought would be fun, but I didn't really think, I didn't have much faith that it would be technically possible to do it. So my enthusiasm was low, is what I'm getting at.
Because all the other things you'd come up with were being done. I mean, well, there was just kind of like, okay, check that one off kind of thing, or?
Well, no, the things that I had, you know, wanted to learn next, refinement of structures, the molecules that I proposed to work on were being worked on by other people in the lab, and that left this other project, which I had certainly proposed to do it, but I didn't have much heart for it.
And as you mentioned, you were in this kind of lull anyway.
Yeah. So I spent some time just trying to sort out what it was I should do. And started a number of things that all failed. But I would say this work was done in the context of the sense that I was immortal, you know, and didn't have a...
Mm-hmm. What were some of the... I mean, you know, I take it there were attempts to try to figure out a way to get some sort of image or get some sort of crystal at...
Yeah, crystals of new proteins mostly and things like that.
And so you actually tried, you know, or... to do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Can you, I mean, do you want
to... I don't even remember what they were, to tell you the truth.
They were really bad. Yeah. Okay.
No, they didn't work. I've forgotten. I mean, I could dig out my lab notebooks and...
Well, I think at this point, please don't throw them away.
Okay.
Or give them to me, or... Well, no, I mean, but,
yeah.
They'll find their way somewhere someday, I hope. Hopefully. Be a vital... resource to those who want to kind of look at it in more detail.
Anyway, so eventually what happened was that a postdoc in a lab upstairs, Rick Dahlquist's lab, a postdoc named Marilyn Carey, went to a meeting at Cold Spring Harbor on site-directed mutagenesis. And it was a workshop, really, that was run by Mark Zoller. It was one of the people with Mike Smith who'd invented site-directed mutagenesis. And Marilyn came back with essentially a notebook of protocols on how to do this stuff. And she and I were friends, and it seemed like an obvious thing to start applying to phage lysozyme. It fit right in with my experience sequencing trisphosphate isomerase gene. So I knew how to handle plasmids and sequence and things like that. So I think it was probably the summer of 84.
And you had some sense that people were already using this sort of genetic, not necessarily site-directed, but mutagenesis studies, if you will, on stability, protein stability questions, or on...
Well, that was something that Brian Matthews really... pioneered, and it was something that was done jointly with George Streisinger. George was a phage geneticist who developed screens for mutants of phage lysozyme in the 60s and had developed a collection of point mutants of lysozyme. George's claim to fame really was to use frameshift mutations to show that the genetic code used in vivo was the same as the genetic code that had been worked out in vitro in the early 60s. And the frameshift mutants were mutants of lysozyme. And so Streisinger had developed a collection of lysozyme mutants that were temperature sensitive, so that indicated there was some defect in the fold. Something that held the protein together had been damaged by the mutation. And in the second half of the 70s, Brian Matthews' group set about to find out what these mutations were and to determine the structures of the mutant proteins.
And he knew Streisand, or this is how he got to know him, because he collaborated.
Well, George was at Oregon.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sometimes in a whole two, you know.
Sorry, I should have made that clear. So
no.
One of the best things about the group in Eugene is that there were five different groups working on this one protein. So Streisinger had developed the genetics. Mm-hmm. Matthews, with Jim Remington, had done the crystal structure in the early 70s. Rick Dahlquist had been applying NMR methods to try to study the protein.
Did you say NMR?
NMR.
Okay.
Yeah, nuclear magnetic resonance. John Shellman is one of the leading sort of thermodynamic theorists and experimentalists in the country. Mm-hmm. He had developed methods to reversibly denature T4 lysozyme, and a student, Peg Elwell, in his lab developed a lot of the methods for measuring how strong is this protein. And if you make a change, how does that change?
And then
make it stronger,
the point
weaker?
Mutations.
No, this is just a straight wild type protein, and it was hard to make. It's a lot of work. They had to infect a large number of liters of E. coli cells with the virus,
mm-hmm.
and get the lysate from virally infected cells. And the second step in the prep was to dilute the whole thing to 60 liters and then flow it over a column that was the size of a football player's leg, basically. And
sounds like Avery in his lab.
Oh, it's really bad. I mean, by
step
modern
after step after
what,
step.
Yeah, I mean, what we call modern standards, it was really bad. So a typical protein purification would take a month. And once the proteins were purified, the mutations were identified by protein sequencing. Not even sequencing, actually. What was done was to chop up the protein with a protease,
mm-hmm.
find the piece that purified differently on a ion exchange column, mm-hmm. and then not even sequence that. The experiment that was done was to determine the composition of the piece. And by determining the composition of the piece and knowing the sequence of the protein, they could guess what amino acid sequence change or
changes. This is all before the recombinant stuff, right? I mean, you're still talking now into the, like, at the best, the latest we're moving up to is like
1780.
Okay.
We're talking, okay.
And that's why, of course, they stuck with lysozyme, right? I mean, of the T4, because they had it. From, they could do this kind of backward.
Well, the phage genetics was worked out, so you could make the mutants efficiently and screen for mutants. And Streisinger had made this beautiful collection of mutants that we eventually, with new methods, characterized and published a comprehensive paper in 1987 that ended up being one of the most important parts of the whole postdoc, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got to Brian's lab in the beginning of 82, there were no what are called pipettemen, sort of adjustable pipettes for delivering reproducibly small volumes of liquid. And these were, standard procedure in molecular biology labs and many protein labs, but Brian's lab was still working with glass pipettes, which had to be cleaned after every use.
And that was just because they were slow? Or
it's just a different world,
yeah.
Really. So, the first thing I did was order pipettemen. And
different world.
It was a different world, yeah. So, anyway, Marilyn got back from the Cold Spring Harbor course, and I thought, gee, this is something that nobody else in Matthew's lab is doing, make site-directed mutants.
And if I could she kind of brought this back because she was interested, and she'd gone there particularly to get... I mean, to hear that it was a class she went to the summer's class.
It was a workshop,
And then she also brought it to your attention because she knew you might be interested in it.
Yeah. She was working in chemotaxis with Rick Dahlquist. So we made some vectors for mutagenesis that had the lysozyme gene cloned in a convenient way and sequenced those and got people to make oligonucleotides for us to introduce mutations in the lysozyme gene. And you know, back then the hard thing was getting oligonucleotides. Now, you know, you just go and punch it in the machine and it's made. But
as I said, the last time they get delivered to,
or they get delivered pure, yeah. So, you know, I felt that it was really important to compare the properties of multiple mutations at a given site. And so, because oligonucleotides were dear, we had degenerate mixtures of oligonucleotides made, and then we did the mutagenesis and then sequenced hundreds of clones to get the ones that we wanted. Whereas now you just make them all separately. So it's a little bit different style. And
a lot more work, or?
Well, yeah, it was a lot more work, yeah. Yeah.
But pretty regular kind, I mean, you had it down so that it wasn't the kind of work that kept getting screwed up. I mean, it was just a matter of cranking it out sort of thing, or it was really
No, you had to be very careful. There was no kit for sequencing DNA, for example, so you had to make the reagents and you had to make sure they were, you know, perfect, because that really influenced the quality of the sequencing results. So that's just one example.
Mm-hmm. But your being careful kind of made it pretty consistent.
Yeah, you had to be careful. Yeah. Right about that time, one of the neat things is that Brian was on sabbatical in the lab, which then he wasn't teaching, but we were starting to produce these site-directed mutants of lysozyme, and a postdoc in Rick Dahlquist's lab had made an expression vector and generously gave it to us to express our mutants. And